Final case for argument this morning, number 5, Richard and Sarah Zalek versus J.P. Morgan Chase National Bank.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Josh Trumbull. I represent the Zaleks. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, 4 minutes. All right, you may proceed.
Thank you. In 2006, Chase acquired the servicing rights to the Zaleks ETX note and deed of trust. They collected payments, and there were no issues for the next 4 years until approximately 2010. In December 2010, about the 4th of December, Chase received a letter from Mr. Zalek, essentially saying, I'm having financial troubles. We've sold what we can. We can't continue to meet our obligations. I'd like to resolve this so that all the parties can come out the way that they should. Specifically stated that they could potentially sell the home. They could do a short sale. They could do a deed in lieu, a loan mod, just anything other than a foreclosure. So, Mr. Zalek did this, I think November was the missed payment. So within 30 days of November 1st, he informed Chase. He did not hear back. He just simply received statements saying, you're behind 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. Mr. Zalek followed up with several letters, essentially repeating the same, saying, my understanding, I need to make sure I pay the right person. Can you please provide me evidence that that's you? Did not receive anything back until he got a notice of default where Chase, the loan servicer, told him in plain language that they were the owner of his note. He had figured out that you could go onto the Fannie Mae website and find out, and Fannie Mae was actually claiming to own his note. Shortly after April 2011, when Chase said that they were the note owner, he received a letter. It looks like in response to his, several months worth of writing to Chase saying that, in fact, Chase didn't own it. And, my reading of it, you can't really tell who owns it in that letter. It says that it's owned by a security managed by Fannie Mae. So that's what this case is about. The Zalek's Consumer Protection Act case is about that Chase was the servicer. Chase has a duty to provide accurate and timely information to all parties involved in the transaction. There's a federal statute that says borrowers are entitled to know who the owner is of their note. That's 12 U.S.C. 2605. Might be per NG, but it's in there. So from December through January through February through March is when the Zaleks were injured under the CPA. By Chase's essentially non-responsiveness, and then
what year was that again?
2010 to 2011, and that's when things got started. If Chase would have simply provided the truth in a letter or an explanation that an average consumer can read, which is what the standard is under the CPA, it's Mr. Zalek was telling them, "We will sell the home and pay you in full," and instead, all of a sudden, he was 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months behind. He'd racked up fees and still was never provided any information. So that's the factual background. I know what I want to talk about today, but is there anything that the panel would like me to focus on? No? Okay. So there's essentially four legal issues that we would like to have the court examine. The first legal issue is the collateral estoppel issue. I think that Chase clearly waived that at the trial court. The res judicata issue, the Zalek's position is that it does not prohibit them from having their claims heard because we don't have the identities required, and the previous complaint was never decided on the merits, and Chase is asking for a non-mutual bar to hearing Zalek's claims. So under the CPA, the Handlin decision from 2015, I think is instructive. The Zaleks were entitled to this information. Denial of having this information when the facts are viewed in the light most favorable to the Zalix, having the information would have prevented the last 6 or 7 years of harm and struggle. And so just like in Hamlin, where the people looking for the apartment, they were denied their credit file, and that caused them damage. It's the same thing here. So under the CPA, the Zalix believe they've stated a claim, and it's backed up by the case law. Regarding the interpretation of the note, there's been a lot in this area of law about holder and beneficiary and things like that, but I have not seen a case regarding what to do with essentially Washington's version of the UCC, which the framers and the codifiers of that specifically say if parties want to change it, they are completely free to do that. And that's, you know, based in essentially the founding of the country, parties have a freedom to contract. And so in this case, note holder is defined. We don't need to use the gap filler definition that's part of Title 62. So in this case, when Mr. Zalix entered into the note, the note holder is the entity that takes the note by transfer and is entitled to receive the payments. And there's evidence in the record that when Mr. Zalix entered into that, he understood that receiving the payments did not mean a middleman or a middle company. It actually meant the person that would end up with them. And so that's our argument for the note holder.
Okay. You'll have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Hugh McCullough, and I represent J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. The Superior Court rightly decided that Zalix had no claim under the Consumer Protection Act, and rightly decided that Chase, by virtue of its possession of the original executed promissory note, was entitled to judgment against the Zalix. But this court is not the first court to have heard this exact configuration of facts, or to have heard the Zalix arguments about the notices and whether the notices were satisfactory to the Zalix. Those exact facts were previously litigated in connection with a case that was commenced in state court in 2012.
You know, we understand that, but there is a kind of an argument there that because of Iqbal and Twombly, it's different when it's in federal court because of the difference in a 12b6.
That's true, but a couple of things. So first, I don't think the Zalix have pointed to any authority that suggests that a judgment on the merits under a 12b6 motion in federal court is treated differently from a judgment on the merits in any other case. In fact, quite to the contrary, the cases that we cite from the Washington Court of Appeals note that for res judicata purposes, you look at federal law to determine whether it is a judgment on the merits, one that has preclusive effect. And the Stewart case from the Ninth Circuit says a judgment on the merits includes an order dismissing claims under 12b6, because under Rule 41 of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, that is a judgment on the merits, and it has preclusive effect. But
well,
the equities
that
would
be more helpful to the court if you talk about the Consumer Protection Act elements on the merits, and particularly, I guess, the focus is, was there an unfair and deceptive act or practice under Washington consumer protection law?
There was not an unfair.
The allegation is that Chase committed an unfair or deceptive act or practice when it callously refused to answer letters in 2010-11 timeframe asking for information about who actually owned the note.
Sure.
That's alleged to be an unfair and deceptive act or practice. Why is it not?
A couple of reasons. First, the information that the Zalix were asking for, who has authority to collect payments, who has authority to deal with you, was information that was already in its possession and had been since 2006 when it was first notified that Chase was the servicer for the loan. And the letters they received from Countrywide, the previous servicer, and from Chase itself explained what that meant, that Chase had the right to collect payments from you. That's in the record at 474 and 674. So the information that he needed to know, who do I deal with, who do I make payments to, was information that he had had since 2006. In fact, he had acted on that very information because he had been making payments to Chase consistently during that four-year period leading up to his default in 2010.
Well, I suppose arguably he would say, well, of course, that was my monthly payments and I wasn't really thinking about it, but now I'm talking about like large sum of money to pay the whole thing off. So who am I going to give it to make sure that I don't get double billed?
Sure. So a couple of responses. First, the record that we have from his letters in the December, January, February time frame do reflect that he was receiving responses from Chase. He expresses dissatisfaction with those responses, but Chase is responding. He receives a letter in April 1, 2011, that says, we're willing to work with you to help you if we can in connection with this loan. That's in the record at CP479. He then receives a letter April 14th of 2011 that says, you've asked who the owner is. It's FNMA, essentially Fannie Mae. And then later in July of 2011, he receives a letter that encloses a copy of the note, a deed of trust, and a payment history that includes in plain English an explanation of the relationship that Chase has, which is to say that Chase is the one that's entitled to enforce.
And what's the date of that letter?
That one was July 5th, 2011, and it appears in the record at 482. Then there's another letter that appears at 306 later on this year. And then, in response to an inquiry that was directed by the Zalax to the Washington Attorney General, there's yet another letter, and that appears at the record at CP190. So, and to be clear, all of this preceded the recordation of a notice of trustee's sale in 2012. The nonjudicial foreclosure didn't get rolling until that period, although there had been an earlier notice of default. So all of these things preceded the time when Mr. Zalax claims that there was injury as a result of the nonjudicial foreclosure. The nonjudicial foreclosure was scheduled for a sale in July of 2012, and just 8 days before, he commenced the action that was earlier resolved, including in proceedings with the Ninth Circuit.
So why is Hamblin versus on-site manager not the dispositive precedent that counsel believes it is?
I think all that Hamblin says, as I understand it, is that there is some obligation to communicate with the other party. But Chase did communicate. Chase was communicating continually with the Zalax. It's not that there is anything in the record that Chase gave him a deceptive statement or said something that was untrue. It's that the Zalax were unhappy with the answers that they were receiving or refused to believe them. Chase said repeatedly, look, we're the ones that you work with. We're the ones entitled to enforce the note. And there's no question that that was true. I think as of today, Chase is still in possession of the original note endorsed in blank. I have it in my briefcase. Chase has had, there's nothing in the record to reflect anything other than that Chase was in possession of the original note all the way back to 2006. Fannie Mae, under its servicing guidelines, which are described in the DITEC case, which is one of the supplemental authorities, Fannie Mae doesn't deal directly with borrowers. It's not equipped to do so. It doesn't have the employees to do so. That's what it's compensating the servicers to do. And so having the information that it was Fannie Mae, which, to be clear, they had within a couple of months after he first started making inquiries, wouldn't have helped him in any meaningful way because the same person was still the person that he was communicating with, which was Chase. And Chase gave him ample opportunity to make contacts with them and to work with them in connection with the Consumer Protection Act issues.
So it seems that Chase, in your position, is the holder of the note under the Deed of Trust Act. What about the argument that there's been some modification of the terms of the who is a holder or owner of the note?
Well, it's clear that Chase is not the owner. The owner is Fannie Mae. And Chase is the holder of the note. Under Brown and Bain, the 2012 and 2015 decisions from the Washington Supreme Court, Brown versus the Washington Department of Commerce actually was specifically in connection with a Freddie Mac note that was owned by Freddie Mac. And the court said, look, what we look at, who's the holder? That's what matters for purposes of the Deed of Trust Act. That's who matters for purposes of who's entitled to enforce the instrument. And so long as Chase was the holder, which it was entitled to take the actions that it did, which it did. All matters which, by the way, were ventilated in connection with the prior action in the federal court matter and that were resolved and are binding as res judicata here. I think it's also important to note that there really has never been or any dispute about Chase's right to enforce the instrument because the judgment that was entered by the court down below in connection with its possession of the original executed promissory note, there's no evidence that there was anybody other than Chase that was ever entitled to enforce the instrument. And as a consequence, a lot of the allegations that were originally part of the prior action were really founded on this idea that Chase wasn't the person entitled to enforce. If you look back at the original complaint and its subsequent iterations, they started out with the premise that, well, Chase, because you're not the owner, it says that's Fannie Mae, you can't be foreclosing. Since the Washington Supreme Court said those theories don't work anymore, they've simply changed the legal theories. But the underlying facts are still the same. We're still talking about the very same documents. We're still talking about the very same communications. And we're talking about legal theories that could have been ventilated earlier. They weren't until this judicial foreclosure action was commenced in 2015, when at that point, and only at that point, did the Zalacs come forward with new legal theories based on the same facts. And those are undoubtedly precluded by principles of res judicata. You don't, if you've got the set of facts possessed to you, then your obligation is to come forward with all the legal theories that you've got. You don't get a second crack at the apple. And we don't have different courts, federal and state, acting as courts of appeals for each other. At least, I suppose we could construct
are
things
you,
that
way. You are talking now about the argument that Judge Trickey asked you about, which is that the one we just heard saying that, well, holder of the note might mean something in the law, but you can vary the law by having a different definition of note holder in your contract.
Yeah, well, so let's focus on the language that's in the contract, right? I think that the Zalacs are referring to the language in the note that says the lender or anyone who takes this note by transfer and who is entitled to receive payments under this note is called the note holder. So let's assume that their argument is correct, that somehow that words binds rather than the law that applies. All it does is circle back to Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code because it says the person who is entitled to receive payments under this note. Nothing else in the note explains who that is. So we look to Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code as interpreted by the Washington Supreme Court, and under those principles of law, it's clear the holder of the note, Chase, was and is entitled to enforce.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 4 minutes.
Thank you. On page 4 of the Zalac reply brief, we address the res judicata issue, and I can just read the quote real quickly. As a general rule, when a case has been dismissed on a procedural issue, the court has not given the prior determination res judicata effect because the dismissal was not on the merits. So it's the Zalac's position that the previous complaint, it was dismissed on a 12b6, which is procedural, not on the merits. Essentially, from the Zalac's point of view, this type of things happened about 100 years ago. It was the Osners and Melhorn cases. In those cases, and there was probably 10 or 15 of them that were reported, and I don't know how many others were impacted by it, but it was essentially this exact scenario where Osners and Melhorn was receiving the payments. They got paid off early. Instead of sending the payments to the investors or the owners, the son absconded with the money, and the court came down and said, look, the law in Washington is if you're going to pay somebody money, get your note back, or make sure that you have information from the principal that they're the actual agent, and if you don't do that, you're going to have to pay twice. And that's the scenario that Mr. Zalac found himself in, as he rolled into January of 2011, February of 2011, March of 2011. Sure, Chase was saying, we're the right people to pay. Send us a payment. But they didn't address his question.
Well, they were the right people to pay, weren't they?
I think so.
Well, then it wasn't deceptive to say that, was it?
No, and that's not my point. My point is not it wasn't deceptive to say we're the right people to pay. It was deceptive that they didn't provide him the information. What they should have done, and what would have complied with Osners and Melhorn and Washington law under Ranger, is when he wrote a letter in that said, I can't pay my payments anymore. I'd like to sell my house and I'd like to pay you off. Please provide me information that you're the right party. I think what's required to protect himself is that they send him and say, look, here's how it's set up. Chase is the servicer. The note has been securitized. It's in a trust owned or managed by Fannie Mae, and here's the proof. Here's a statement from Fannie Mae that gives Chase the ability to collect payments.
Well, that would have been a possible more expansive and educational, exposition of the law of Washington, but I just don't know of any case that says that when, you know, you accurately say, I'm the person you're supposed to pay, and the person says, well, geez, I don't understand why you're saying that. You might be wrong, that you're then entitled to have that person give you, like, a law school education about why things are the way they are. I mean, if that were true, anybody could ask anything. You know, why is it that, you know, that you can non-judicially foreclose against me? Explain that to me. I thought it had to be a court that did it.
Sure. Well,
and so then Chase would have to write back and say, no, you know, 30 years ago the legislature passed the Non-Judicial Foreclosure Act, and ever since then it's been well accepted.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a good enough explanation, because I'm not sure that that explanation, I'm not sure that statute is constitutional. Could you please explain to me how that passes muster under?
And I can see that concern from the court. To be clear, that's not what I'm advocating for. I'm advocating for essentially what the court laid out in Coppler v. Bugie and cases like that, where, and the United States Congress in 12 U.S.C. 2605, and this court in Hanlon says that when people are entitled to possess information, it's unfair, deceptive not to provide them that information. I don't think that Chase needed to provide them a law school exam or a brief, but I do think that the Zalix were entitled to know who the owner was, how Chase, just as a general agency, how Chase is an actual agent or entitled to collect the facts. And I think this whole thing, they probably would have sold their home and paid the note in full, but for Chase failing to provide them that information. And then later on, Chase providing them information that actually was inaccurate by saying that they were the note owner when they weren't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes this matter, and that also concludes our calendar this morning.
We will be in recess.